From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 23, 2013, in London. Prime Minister David Cameron said that he supported a referendum to allow voters to decide for themselves whether to stay in the European Union. But Cameron rejected the idea that a simple in or out vote should happen immediately. He said that first, the UK should negotiate new terms and conditions with the EU. And then Cameron promised that voters would have their referendum and decide whether the new rules were good enough or whether it was truly time to leave. Cameron said that the referendum would happen by 2017. He said that voters would have control of their own destiny. And he asked them that day, when they eventually did get around to voting, when the time came, he said, vote with cool heads. He said voters would have to weigh whether going it alone is truly in the national interest. That referendum finally came last week, and by a narrow margin, voters decided to leave the European Union. The decision coming as a shock to many commentators who assumed the final outcome could reflect Scotland's saber-rattling a couple of years ago, which ultimately led to a decision to stay in the UK. Cameron promptly announced he's resigning. That opens the question of who will be the next prime minister and whether that prime minister will move quickly to invoke the steps to leave the EU. What does this mean for the British people? What does it mean for those living abroad? What does it mean for us? Let's explore those questions and more with our guests for this hour. John Elson is here, and he is visiting, as he does every summer. He curates the Made in the UK series for the Rochester International Jazz Festival. So you've been here since essentially, John, the beginning of the Jazz Festival here, yeah?
Yes. John Nugent, who's the festival director, was an old friend of mine beforehand. And so when he set up this festival 15 years ago, I said, you better need some help here. So I came over and brought a friend, and we just gave him every support, and he's built this festival and something.
Isn't it beautiful?
I love it. I love it. So for the last 8 years, I've been bringing over eight groups of musicians, British musicians, to play at the event, and everybody loves it. It's fabulous.
And oh, by the way, you happen to work with someone decently well-known in 1975. You work with Margaret Thatcher?
Yeah. Yeah, I yes, it was very strange because I just finished my postgrad in Amsterdam University on European integration and political union. So I'd just written a paper about it. And then, of course, we got thrown into the referendum. And so I came back to London quickly and joined the central campaign office and became a coordinator. And Margaret Thatcher, of all people, she wasn't the Prime Minister then, of course, but she would come in very regularly to give all support to the campaign coordinators and to make sure that Britain went into Europe. So it was a fascinating time, her and many of the other major politicians who worked.
We'll have plenty to talk about. And Colin Coffey is here as well. He's the co-owner of South Wedge Wellness LLC. Immigrated to the United States in 1994, yes?
Yes, I did, Evan. And a quick correction to John. Margaret Thatcher was not there to make sure Britain went into the European Union. Ted Heath, the former Prime Minister, took Britain into the European Economic Community in 1973 without any vote whatsoever. So I think we, you know, without saber-rattling too much, let's, keep it fact-based.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you got that right. Okay, Colin, this one you win, but the next one you won't.
Colin, for you, what's a little bit of your background in the UK? You're from where?
I was born in St Albans, Hertfordshire, to two working-class immigrant Irish parents. My mum went to England at 14 to work as a maid. So I grew up, got a great education as part of the changes that the Labour Party made in 1945 to open access to education, healthcare, and housing to ordinary working class people. And I think a good point to mention is people could move freely from Ireland to England and have children and bring them up. And there wasn't a huge big issue about borders at that time. So while there were borders elsewhere across Europe, if you were travelling, you could travel pretty freely from Ireland to England. And this explains why so many people of Irish origins are from England.
I'll start with you, Colin. Just a first reaction to the vote last week. We've seen a lot of hyperbole on all sides. We've seen some wondering if this vote will stand, that ultimately if there will be some kind of invocation of either a new referendum or if Parliament will seek to thwart the will of the voters. John Cassidy in The New Yorker writing today that this is not a binding vote, this is an advisory vote, and that while while Parliament thwarting the will of the voters could lead to unrest, perhaps there could be some way to avoid Article 50, et cetera. So let me just start with your general reactions, and we'll kind of take it from there. What did you make of the outcome? Were you surprised?
I didn't take a position on it because I couldn't vote because I've been here for 19 years. Mm-hmm. My friends and family are evenly split on the question. The thing that struck me being in the US was the total paralysis and blindsiding of the entire political and media class. From the Conservative Party to the Liberal Party to the Greens to the Scottish Nationalists to the Welsh Nationalists, from left to right, every European leader and also even President Obama sort of strapped in to arrive into London to say, if you leave, you'll go to the back of the queue. And yet there was a 72% turnout. The highest ever election turnout in the United States was 1960 when Kennedy ran against Nixon. So I think it's hard for people to imagine the level of engagement to get a 72% turnout. And the previous turnout was about 63% in 1974-75. Yeah. So 51% voting to leave against the weight of advice from all of those figures speaks to a political earthquake. And I think we need to stop and pause and think, why did that happen?
Okay. Yeah. What do you think, John?
I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I was very much pro us staying in. But the first thing is, Cameron should never have called this election. It was just a dumb thing to do. And he did it purely because he had problems within his own party, because all the other parties in the country said, no need for an election here, only if there's a change in treaty. So he made a big blunder on that basis. Then the Remain campaign was so vitriolic. They were threatening every moment. And these are people that I was hoping would represent my views of staying in Europe, but they didn't.
Did they call that Project Fear?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And the those that wanted out were very smart and stayed away from it. Instead of the personal insults that were being hurled at them, they came back with their arguments. And actually, the people of Britain listened to those arguments in the end and went out and voted. And although it sounds like it's they won by a small majority, actually it's huge, because nobody expected the Brexits to be anywhere near 50%. I think we were 2-1 in 75-4. And now, you know, it was amazing.
Now, I mean, Colin's actually absolutely right. Just yesterday on this program, we talked about just how negatively voters in this country view government. Congress has low approval ratings, etc. Clearly, in the UK, there is an anti-government sentiment because they're not listening to all of these leaders who told them you've got to stay. And what I want to do is I want to listen to some comments that were made, because I think there are two arguments being made now about why this happened. First of all, you have those saying this is about xenophobia and racism. And you also have those saying that the Leave side made false promises. And John Oliver, who hosts Last Week Tonight on HBO, he picked up on what he perceives as the false promises of the Leave side, and now they've got to grapple with it. So this is John Oliver on his show.
I'm not even sure the pro-Brexit camp had planned on winning, because the next day, they started speaking a lot more carefully about the promises that had been made. You might remember that campaign bus, which read, "We send the EU £350 million a week, let's fund our National Health Service instead." Well, here's Nigel Farage the morning after the vote.
"The £350 million a week we send to the EU, which we will no longer send to the EU, can you guarantee that's going to go to the NHS?
"No, I can't, and I would never have made that claim. That was one of the mistakes, I think, that the Leave campaign made."
Oh, now you're telling us!
All right, so that's John Oliver. So let's start with that. We'll get to the whole whether there's xenophobia and racism in a minute, but set that aside. John Oliver saying false promises, and now they've got to grapple with it. Is that an oversimplification, John?
Yeah, I think you have to flip that coin and look at the Remain campaign, because they made no real headway in convincing people. Sure, there was some nonsense spoken both sides, to be quite honest. And, you know, this whole thing about this additional money going into the health service. And people weren't fooled by things like that. They didn't buy into Brexit or getting out of it just because of that. I think it's much, much deeper than that.
Okay, Colin?
I would agree with John. I think John Oliver does a great job at what he does, and that's a funny skewering. But I think that the political classes need to look deeper. And I think one of the things that I found so offensive with a lot of the coverage is how classist it was. And how it smeared anybody that wanted to leave the European Union as a racist or a xenophobe. I know you said you didn't want to get into that now.
No, that's fine.
But I found it very offensive. And the whole notion, I think, that we also have here in the US that the political class says these are the positions that are acceptable. And the Democrats and the Republicans are coming across as part of the same establishment, and there's an anti-establishment mood. And the reason the anti-establishment mood is here is because of very clear economic reasons. Working people are not seeing the benefits of globalization. They're seeing all of the disadvantages, pressures on social services, cuts to housing, education, welfare, and they're not seeing the huge benefits of globalization, which are going to the top 1%. And there's no one in the political class advocating for a real socialist alternative. And that's why we're in the pickle that we're in. The working people in England, not all of them, some of them were reactionary, but a lot of people have got a gut reaction wanting something different, but nobody's offering an alternative, which is why all of the political parties were wrong-footed.
Yeah, Colin, I've got to totally agree with you on that. This whole idea of xenophobia and the problems of migration, really there are problems, and they're problems that we've had a huge amount of migration coming in from Europe, positive migration, as we have over the centuries. It is large, and the one problem we have is on housing strains, education strains, and health strains for our healthcare. Well, sure, well, we should invest in that because the people coming in are working, and that's always been the history of migration into our country. But there's another side to this that people got upset about and started bringing into the equation and saying, you know, this is what Brexit's think, which was actually untrue. But, you know, we're a humanitarian country. We take in people that need help, and we have a very, very positive way of working at the moment in Syria, you know, helping in the camps that are there and bringing people out from those camps to the UK. It has to be organised and controlled because there's no point bringing people over and not having a house for them to live in. I mean, we have those problems there. But Angela Merkel, in the middle of all this, just turned around and said, well, I don't agree with that. I'm just going to open up the borders. Well, chaos, absolute chaos in Europe. The European Union had no answer to it whatsoever, and yet they knew this problem was coming. So the Brexit's just honed in on that and said, look, no organization. We can do better ourselves, as we are doing.
I think what we see is sometimes there's this desire to paint any concern about immigration as racist and xenophobic.
Yeah.
And there's probably some non-zero element that is, maybe bigger than close to zero. But at the same time, I don't think it's xenophobic to say that someone, if someone were to say, I support migration, I support immigration, but I want to make sure that there are, you know, there's housing and job opportunity, because if we bring someone in there, the system can't support them, there isn't housing, there aren't jobs, then they're not going to live a good life, and we can't support them, and taxpayers can't support them. And if that strain happens, that there has to be a push and pull. So it shouldn't be zero, but it also, maybe we have to make sure that we understand a balance there. And I think maybe that was part of the Brexit.
Here's some basic facts to add in. In 2000, there were around 3,000 people in the United Kingdom resident who were from Poland. Between 2004 and 2014, that number went to 790,000. There were similarly around 1,500 people from Romania who were resident in England. That number at 2014 is about 150,000. So you're looking at 1 million new people coming into the UK just through enlargement, not because of the war in Syria or anything else like that. That's an enormous amount of people in a very short amount of time. And at the same time, British ordinary people, if you live on a council estate in Bradford, where are the benefits of European integration? They're nowhere to be found. The estates are still run down. The educational opportunities that I had as a working class immigrant no longer exist. There are no free, there are no tuition paid places at the University of Sussex with a full living grant to working class kids. Those opportunities don't exist anymore. But people from outside of the United Kingdom can come and study in the UK. So you've got to, I think we see that here and in many other places, working people feel that the opportunities to get ahead are being kicked away. And we're being told that if you oppose immigration, you're a racist. And that is simply not washing. And I think part of the vote, 51% and a 72% turnout, is that frustration that, you know, we're not being heard.
Well, I think you're right about the frustrations there. I mean, the thing is, the British economy has been growing. It's one of the, it is the biggest in Europe anyway. It needs migrant workers coming in with skills. And the joke in England, of course, is if you need a plumber or a builder, ring a Polish guy. And sure enough, we needed those skills over here. On the flip side of it, of course, we've drained skills out of those other European countries, and the European Union are looking at that with concern, because it means that a lot of Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Hungary, they're losing a lot of their skilled workers at a time when they actually need to develop in their own country. So there is a flip side to that. But yeah, it's I don't believe in the xenophobic side of it. I think that was a scam put out by the Stay In.
Here's the comments from Boris Johnson, leader of the Leave movement and possible next Prime Minister of the UK. Here's what he writes about those motivations. Mr. Johnson writes, quote, "It is said that those who voted Leave were mainly driven by anxieties about immigration. I do not believe that is so. After meeting thousands of people in the course of the campaign, I can tell you that the number one issue was control, a sense that British democracy was being undermined by the EU system and that we should restore to the people that vital power to kick out their rulers at elections and to choose new ones," end quote. So let me ask John then, because you said you were in favor of Stay, yes?
I was in favor of Stay.
Oh, you weren't definitely happy with the campaign because, in your words, the campaign did peddle fear as opposed to promoting the good of staying.
Absolutely.
So what is the good of staying? Why why would you want to stay?
Because it allowed Britain a huge marketplace in which to trade. And we're a trading nation. We're an island. Trade is at the basis of what we need. So free movement and free access to all those markets was as important to us in the UK as it is important to those in Europe. Free access of movement. Remember, we're talking about immigration into the UK. There's also a huge amount of emigration. A large number of Brits live in Spain and live in Portugal. The huge amount of British skilled workers and certainly blue-collar work in Europe themselves. So it's given great opportunities, both sides. And that freedom may well be, we may have shot ourselves in the foot there. Funnily enough, I don't think so, because I think Europe needs us as much as we need.
Well,
Europe.
You got to sell it here. Tell me on Stay then. if you don't think.
Well, that's why I think we should. No, I actually believe that this is going to be. We have a short-term problem here. The medium term, though, is how we can build that bridge up, and that bridge has to include us having great trade relations. We need that as much as I believe Europe needs that as well. And I believe in the freedom of people to move in work-wise throughout that area, because otherwise it will very badly affect us.
Okay. Colin?
Well, I think it's Boris Johnson's comment is to be expected. He's a right-wing conservative. So, of course, he's wanting to lay claim to the 51% who wanted to leave as backing his agenda, which was about sovereignty and Great Britain and blah, blah, blah. Really, people were pissed off. And really, the reason they're pissed off, if you excuse my French, is because of austerity, because of shrinking living standards, because of looking at what's happening to the potential future of their children and their grandchildren. And really, the question for staying in Europe or leaving was a bit like being asked, do you want to have your bath at 8 or at 6 as a kid? You don't want the bath at all. And I think one element that's missed out of this is that, you know, people look at the United States, we still don't have a universal healthcare system here. In 2016. In 1945, the conservative British people who just got through the Second World War voted by a landslide for a Labour Party government that nationalised the top commanding heights of the economy, introduced a health service, nationalised the coal industry, and provided more education and housing opportunities in one of the most difficult periods. British people know that they can fight alone against the Nazi state because we had no help in 1940. In 1945, we decided to go on a completely different direction. And we still have the benefits of the National Health Service, and the United States is still struggling to get it. You don't get that kind of change without leadership. And the Labour Party at that time believed in a socialist transformation of society. And that's what they went ahead to do. However, the Labour Party offers no leadership right now. And I think that's the question. It's the collapse of the left. And if there's no left alternative, then people are going to take the opportunity to register a protest vote, even if it means putting an X on the same box as someone you might find absolutely reprehensible, like Boris Johnson, or that horrible man from the United Kingdom Independence Party.
Farage.
Farage, yeah.
You know, you're mentioning about Boris here. I mean, because I'm looking and hearing from my friends over there what's happening. And, of course, it's the political elite that are being culled at the moment. David Cameron's got his comeuppance. And it's Nightmare on Elm Street for the Conservative Party. Boris is obviously... has a degree of popularity in the right wing of the Conservative Party, but there is also Theresa May, who is a major politician in the party and on the front benches, and she may be an alternative for them. And I wish the party every success. I have nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with Cameron calling this. They call this upon themselves. I am concerned that we do need strong opposition, and the certainly the Labour Party opposition has been going through a hiatus over the past year or so, and it had Jeremy Corbyn, who never wanted to lead the party at all. They made it very clear. Is now probably, if he hasn't left by now, I'm looking at my watch, it will be probably tomorrow, and there'll be new elections going on there. So it'll be interesting, and this culling of the political elite is absolutely, funnily enough, out of chaos comes a new order, and maybe it's a positive one for us, because I think the public, and they showed it in this vote, they ignored the majority of politicians that were saying, oh, you have to stay in.
You are the most sanguine Leave voter I've met.
I know, but it's what it is. You have to deal with the situation as it is. I can't change that vote, and neither do I want to. If the people have said they want to leave, that's what it's got to be. Let's work on that. Let's now have a culling. And they've said that the political elite, the establishment, you know, all these global companies say, if you don't stay, you know, you're going to lose jobs. We won't put our money. They're not paying their taxes in our country, by the way. We have a big problem going on there with the so-called global companies not even paying their taxes. The man in the street understands that because he pays his taxes.
Yeah, and what I'm getting in this conversation is, for those who think this is a bellwether for the American election in November, I'm not sure, but the parallel I do see is this concern about globalization and the working class, because they don't see the benefits. The UN says that by the year 2050, 80% of the world's population will be in cities. So we're seeing migration towards cities, and anybody in rural areas especially. You know, here in Rochester, drive 45 minutes southwest of here, and there are people, there will be Trump signs, there will be people who are angry about lack of industry, jobs that have moved away, and they don't see anybody doing anything about it. And look, it's much more complicated. It's above my pay grade to fully understand it. But what I think we probably have to do as adults in this country, in the UK, and around the world, is have a conversation about what globalization means going forward. That it may not be the kind of job where when you're in your 20s, you can have a job, and if you can stay in that job for 30 to 40 years, and you can retire, and you never have to think about leaving. I mean, careers may be much more malleable by definition and by necessity because of globalization, and maybe we've got to grapple with that, and I don't really know how to do that.
I've done it personally. I've been outsourced. I went to India to train my replacement. And, you know, my response to it was to become self-employed and do something that can't be done in India, which is why I'm a massage therapist. But I think that I was fortunate to have a great university education and go to grad school here in America. Most of the people that I grew up with haven't had those educational opportunities. And, you know, I think part of the picture that we need to look at is what happened to Greece. You saw in Greece in 2011, their economy shrunk 9.1%.
Yeah.
I mean, there would be pitchforks in the streets in the United States if that happened. And then it was followed by another year of over 7% shrinking in the economy. Greek workers and pensioners were absolutely put to the wall by the European Union. And I think ordinary working people in Britain saw what happened to Greece. And one of the biggest things that came into their equation was this idea that they couldn't leave the euro. Even their left-wing socialist government was too afraid to do that. The UK never took the euro. Britain remained with the pound. And also, if you just look at the export market that Britain, the United Kingdom, provides just to Germany, the Netherlands, and France, just those three countries, it's $200 billion. If you have a customer who spends $200 billion on your goods and services, you don't throw up the drawbridge. The question is, can the left provide an alternative, not just in the United States, but also in Greece and in the UK? And right now, we need new leadership in order to formulate exactly what you said, Evan. The elites in the Labour Party and the Democratic Party are no longer connected as they were 50 years ago to people they fought with, to people they grew up with. They are isolated. And this is why they got this whole vote completely wrong.
And I think, you know, yeah, I agree with you. But I see that in Europe as well. I mean, what we've seen happen in London, and I know that parallels are being looked at with the American situation at the moment. But immediately, I'm more interested to see how the European Union people will react to this, because without any doubt, I'm going to hear clamours for referendums in other countries. I mean, you look at the state of Greece, Portugal, Spain. I mean, these poor countries are being dragged along in the euro at the moment.
John, Texas wants to leave now. Yeah, everybody's going to see. Texit is next.
Yeah, but
Alabexit.
It is this disengagement. This is political disengagement.
Yeah,
it's people disengaged from the people they vote for. Now, it's time the politician wakes up and they have to relate to what's going on. They thought, David Cameron thought this was a doddle. This was an easy way. You know, the Brits will definitely go with me. No, they're not going to do that. They're not going to go with big business threatening them or other governments coming in.
I'd like to pick up on, I know it's a comic point, Texas execute, exit the United States, which it has the right to do under its terms of joining the union. I lived in Texas for 12 years. And I think that kind of thinking is part of the general elite thinking. When people don't agree with us and don't see the validity in the argument because their day-to-day experience in life contradicts those injunctions, then the tendency is always to say, oh, well, the only reason people didn't want to stay in the European Union is because all they want is fish and chips and chip butties and pork sausages and Heinz baked beans. And it's demeaning. I think we need to go back to the idea that ordinary working people might not have as much education as you do. But they are the backbone of our economy, our society. And if we are not doing right by ordinary working people and understanding what their concerns are and relating to them, instead of just constantly dismissing them, we're in for a very, very rough ride.
All right. Well, can I just step in and say I'm very late for our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, to the point that Colin was just making, you're going to hear from an American living in London, in fact, a native of the Rochester area, who is going to talk exactly about that issue. Why were so many people surprised? Because we have sort of segregated ourselves in with those who are like us. And so if you were a stay voter, you probably didn't see it coming as much as maybe Colin says you should have. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with Colin Coffey, the co-owner of the South Wedge Wellness LLC, and John Elson, the curator of the Made in the UK series at the Rochester International Jazz Festival, generously giving his time this afternoon. We'll also take your phone calls in the next half hour. Coming up in our second hour, Jiva Theater Center has a new executive director and a co-CEO, and he has big plans for Jiva as they try to grow their audience. And we're going to talk about that, but they're not alone. The theater scene in Rochester is growing on all kinds of levels, all the way down to grassroots levels. And we're going to talk about the theater scene and the future of growing audience members for the arts scene in Rochester next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about Brexit. I kind of wish we had a more clever name for Brexit. I mean, if the Czechs do it, it's going to be checkout. And, you know, that is, I mean, there has to be better versions of Brexit. And we've got two very clever Brits with us in studio. Couldn't we have done better, Colin and John, than Brexit? I think that reflects the lack of seriousness among the elites who thought it wouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
Because now you're stuck with Brexit.
No, it's not that bad. It could be worse.
Yeah. Well, we'll take your calls here. If you want to call the program with questions about the implications of Brexit, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. I want to turn to a conversation I had with Stephanie Finney. She grew up in Albion, and she works for the London School of Economics now. I began by asking her to tell me how long she has been in London.
I've been here now for about 8 years. I work for the London School of Economics. I'm a program administrator, so I look after a couple master's programs here.
When this vote was coming up here, did you have the sense that it was going to be a lot like Scotland 2 years ago, that there was a lot of saber-rattling, that there was a lot of talk that there would be a leave decision, but ultimately it would be to stay?
Definitely. I think that was what most people were thinking. And I think maybe we got a little complacent because London largely did vote to remain. And so we were surrounded by other people who were really for the remain vote. And then when it happened, I mean, it was just absolute shock everywhere. No one, and still is, people are very worried and really surprised. This was not at all what we expected to have happen.
We've been talking about some of the comments from Boris Johnson and some of the leaders in the Leave movement who have disputed this notion that this is a xenophobic set of voters, that this is a xenophobic decision, that it is, he says it is not about immigration per se, that it's about economics, it's about sovereignty. What do you make of it from your perspective there?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert. I'm just, you know, just a person living here. But I think that there are lots of people who do think it's about immigration. And I do think that is a lot of the rhetoric about wanting to leave was immigration focused. But I agree that's not the case for everyone. And I wouldn't want everyone to be painted with the same brush. I do think there are plenty of people who had, you know, economic reasons why they felt that this was the right thing for the country. But the most press that we saw was really immigration focused. And there's a lot of fallout now that we're seeing on the news of people, you know, from different countries experiencing racism and bad behavior and made to feel uncomfortable for being here. And it's such a shame.
We've also seen Boris Johnson downplay the concerns about the impact on the markets. He says it is a short-term market reaction and that the pound, which is suffering, of course, is, he says it is, you know, still doing better than it was a couple of years ago, that it will have a resurgence and that this is a short-term blip. On the economic side, do you share that view that this is a short-term problem, or are there long-term concerns about the economy there?
This is a non-specialist. But someone who does spends a lot of time transferring money from place to place. I think that we'll see it go up as things calm down a little bit because nothing's going to happen right away. I mean, this vote was advisory. Nothing could happen at all. It's really down to the government to decide. But I think more than likely as things calm down, we'll see the pound improve. But then as it moves forward and decisions are taken, that's when we're, I think it's going to be a volatile time. I think there's going to be a lot of peaks and troughs until it sort of works itself out. But I don't think it's going to recover in the same way. I just, I can't see that happening. I don't think it's going to be those sorts of glory days again for the pound. But I, what do I know? I'm just guessing here.
And you just pointed out the fact that this is technically an advisory vote, that it is still up to Parliament. And John Cassidy in The New Yorker writes that it's his hope and the hope of those on the stay side that Parliament could decide this is not in the interest of the UK and reject the will of the voters in this case. But he also adds that could lead to unrest. From your view there, is there a hunger for a second vote, a chance to say, let's make sure we really want this?
I don't know if it would end up the same again or not, but I do think that there's a lot of people who are expressing surprise because they did not realize the extent to which the EU funds the country. And many of the areas that voted to leave are really financially dependent on the EU's funding, so particularly in Wales, for example. And so, you know, yeah, I would like to see another vote go through. I would like people to have another round of having thought about it and seen what's coming out of all of this. And seeing the government, the unrest within the government, trying to sort out, you know, this is an administrative nightmare to try to rewrite all of these laws. And, yeah, so I don't know what's going to happen, but I can't help but hope. And I think that others around me in London, again, London being a real wanting to remain very much, feel the same way, that we really are hoping that this isn't the end of this and that there's another way.
That's Stephanie Finney. She grew up in Albion. She now works for the London School of Economics, joining us by phone this morning. And on the question of buyer's remorse, a lot has been made of the fact that one of the most common Google searches in Britain the day after the referendum was about what, in fact, the EU even is. Some citizens on the street have told news crews they only voted to leave to make a point, not because they thought their side could win. But here's a prominent Leave supporter declaring some regret. Kelvin McKenzie, the former editor of The Sun, Britain's biggest-selling newspaper, wrote yesterday, quote, "When I put my cross against Leave, I felt a surge as though for the first time in my life my vote did count and I had power. 4 days later, I don't feel quite the same. I have buyer's remorse, a sense of be careful what you wish for. To be truthful, I am fearful of what lies ahead," end quote. All right, both of you are smiling at that.
Yeah.
You don't take him seriously.
Well, no, as a journalist, he's the lowest of the low.
Okay.
I just took one look at Colin as soon as you mentioned his name and we
there
both
you go.
Made the comment, so I wouldn't listen to a word he said, but it was very interesting what Stephanie said in London. I mean, this whole idea, though, that we have to look at it another way, you know, a revote. No way.
Not
no
happening.
Way. No, that was revolution on the street. You've got to take the vote as it is.
That's what David Cameron himself has said.
Yeah, right? of course it is. You cannot do that. However, I mean, I do absolutely firmly believe there are ways of negotiating with the European Union. And the Swiss are not dissimilar because they moved out. They wanted border control and they moved out of the Union. And there are enough countries around and maybe inside the Union at the moment that want to see reforms happen. So there are possibilities for a good negotiating position, much better than the so-called negotiations that Cameron had and came back to the country and said, look at what I've done. And everyone said, what?
What do you think, Colin?
Well, I think that going back to the, do you want to have your bath at 6 or at 8? I think the Greeks are a good example. Their experience, you know, they were asked point blank, you know, do you want in or out of the euro? And they said, out. And then, you know, their left-wing government said, no, we're staying in. So I think anything is potentially possible. One of the things that I think I'd highlight, though, is a lot of this coverage was very classist. It was demeaning. It was implying that, you know, people were in tears afterwards. Yes, there are always people who are in tears after an election when it doesn't go their way. There are always people who maybe felt they didn't understand the issues. But when so many people speak against an array of international and local establishment, business, labour, and international relations, Obama's comment about go to the back of the queue, that was, John and I were talking about it earlier, that was just taken offensive. And, you know, we make our own decisions. And I think that that's where things will go forward. Whether Britain and the UK leaves the EU or renegotiates and stays you know, the Swiss economy and the Norwegian economy are tiny. As I said earlier, Britain is a $200 billion market. It is in a position to negotiate. The real question is going to be, is ordinary working people's lives going to be made better or not? And it doesn't matter whether you're in or out on that criteria.
Well, gentlemen, I've got a full queue of phone calls, so let me start working through these here. And this is Mel in Penfield first up. Go ahead, Mel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My son has lived in London for many years and still does. And in fact, his company does foreign exchange buying and selling. So it's a volatile market, so it's good for his company. But he also agrees with the guests that you have from who lives in London now. In fact, interesting, he just got his MBA from the London School of Economics last summer. But he, interesting perspective, and I'd be interested in hearing from your guests, the polling results that, you know, like in the States, polling really doesn't capture, I think, the true attitudes and prospects for a voter turnout because of cell phones and et cetera. But it's the betting odds ratio that he said was more predictive of Britain leaving the EU. And that was interesting to me. I don't know what equivalent we have here in the States, but he said that was more predictive. So I'd be interested in hearing the perspective from your guests.
Mel, thanks for the phone call. And our guest, anyone from the UK, has a much better handle on betting markets than Americans. So it's in your blood, guys. So go ahead.
I thought they got it completely wrong. I thought they were offering 4-1 odds on staying.
They messed up completely over there.
The bookies got it wrong as well. So I don't know where your son heard that, but... I think part of it is this sort of class divide that's taking place. A lot of it is about the horse race. We have it here in the United States. Abysmal turnout. Turnout in our elections is so low. And here, you know, I just read an article from a professor of economics from the Harvard Law School, which came out on Project Syndicate a couple of days ago, where he was saying this is a failure of democracy. And I'm like, no, 72% of people actually voted. And he was arguing that you should set the vote aside on the grounds that it was a constitutional change. And here you have a Harvard professor who doesn't understand that the United Kingdom joined the European Economic Community in 1972 by government fiat. So there's a huge sort of tendency to substitute fact and information for bewilderment and lack of connection.
Well, I think that's just someone who didn't like the way the vote went and wanted to declare it was some sort of a failure of democracy. When no matter what you think of the Brexit vote, that level of engagement, to Colin's point, reflects something that we should hope for, which is more engagement in our own voting society. Back to the phones, Tony and Geneseo next up. Go ahead, Tony.
Oh, hi. I have several comments, actually. But I really do think that most of the reaction is hysteria. I mean, the market reactions are hysteria.
Yeah.
I don't really think it's such a big deal. I don't believe it's xenophobic. I think Britain is one of the most integrated, culturally integrated countries in Europe, so I don't think it's that. I think it's really control of your borders, and I don't think that's such a big deal. I mean, you know, who's closer? I mean, the United States' biggest trading partner, single biggest trading partner, is Canada. And Americans have to show their passports when we go into Canada, and vice versa. It's not a big deal. And we're very well connected economically. So I also don't think that the trade thing is all that important either. I mean, the United States International Trade Commission already said that the TPP is essentially going to do nothing for the United States, and indeed it's going to reduce our manufacturing capacity.
Sure, but Tony, on your first point there, a lot of the commentators are more comparing the dream of a unified Europe to a European United States. So you're comparing the United States to Canada. Some advocates of stay would say it's more like driving from Iowa to Oklahoma and not having to show a passport. California to Washington State.
But I get that, but the point is that the European Union has expanded so quickly, and it's to me, it's like, it's, you know, just showing a passport isn't going to really he's such a harm to grade.
Tony,
that's what people are concerned about.
Yeah, Tony, yes. This is John. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, actually. I'm a great believer in remaining, but it's no big deal just showing a passport at a border. That isn't the difficulty because people, before we went into the Union, within Europe, yes, we show passports, but you go in and out. You don't have to get visas. You know, the movement is there, and I totally agree with you. I'd like to bring up the first point about the hysteria that you made, and you're absolutely right about that. It sort of was expected because of the way the result panned out, but already the markets are calming down, and I think everybody will take a breather in the UK for the next few weeks and we'll get through this.
Well, Tony, thank you for the phone call. Let me grab next up Miriam in Geneseo. Go ahead,
Hi,
Miriam.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have actually two questions. You can answer both or one of them. I just got back 2 weeks ago from volunteering at the Jungle, the refugee camp in Calais. And so my first question is related to the fact that I met a lot of kids working there. I was one of the old ladies there. But most of the people who were volunteering were young, educated, mostly from UK, from other countries as well. It was leading up to the vote, and I asked them about it, and granted, this is a cohort of highly educated, for the most part, and people on kids on their gap year, they're majoring international studies and globalization, social work, so they're already sort of a certain mindset. And I said, you know, what are you thinking? And I'm only going to say I asked maybe 10 of them. Okay, there were like 100, but I asked 10 of them, and they all said, every single one of them said, I don't really know because I don't understand the implications, so I think I might not vote. It hasn't been really explained to me what this will actually do, and I don't understand the economics of it, and since I don't understand it, I'm not going to vote. And my second point, so I was wondering, my question about that was, how was it explained to everybody, and how did that all go down in terms of publicity around it? And my second question is specifically about places like the Jungle in Calais. Like, I didn't understand, even while I was there, the fences that were all around were supposedly paid for by the UK to the mayor of Calais, and then at a certain point, UK didn't pay for them anymore, but everybody in the jungle's trying to get out and sneak underneath lorries to go across the channel to go to the UK. So how does all of that change in terms of whether the refugees who are trying to get across, do they have a better chance now? Do they have a worse chance now? It's not even officially deemed a refugee camp by the UN, so it's more of a squatter's colony now, just being serviced by volunteers. How does that all play out? And what actually happens to immigration? They talk about immigration, but what actually happens now in terms of autonomy with the UK in either allowing more or fewer people to come across?
All right, Miriam, I've got to jump in because we're down to our last 2 minutes. Gentlemen, you want to take it where you can?
Oh, yeah.
Colin, go.
Number one, to the caller, that the turnout was 72%. And as I said earlier, that's massive. So quite clearly, perhaps a little less education might result in not so much of a paralysis of analysis. British people didn't seem to have a problem of making a decision and voting. And the campaign was 3 months. And even our president here, and I'm a US citizen, I could say, he made a special trip to be part of that information process. Secondly, with regard to the refugee camp and the tragic situation of people in Calais, number one, we should stop using the word jungle as racist, loaded language. I know it's not intended to be so, but that's how it comes across. I think the plight of refugees is something the European Union has failed on, as they failed on Greece. And what we've seen is a massive set of failures by the European Union bureaucracy on immigration, on refugees, on how they treated Greece. And people know that if you're at the bottom of the heap, you could not rely on the European Union to help you.
Okay. Well, some final thoughts. John Nelson, you've got about 30 seconds here. I called you the most sanguine Leave voter I know now,
I'm a pragmatist.
There you go. So what do you expect going forward, Andrew?
Well, to be quite honest, I think a lot will depend on the political makeup in the next few weeks. The markets are quietening down now, and they're going to wait for the changes that happen. And whoever leads in the interim, the Conservative Party, will shape what the negotiations will be like with the European community. There will be negotiations. There will be no worst case case scenario. We're not going to affect or offend anybody out there in Europe.
What we need is a socialist alternative and a left-wing view to challenge the status quo.
And it's not Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, I think it could be him, but is policy-wise...
You guys disagree.
On his way out. Yeah. Sorry.
His policies and ideas will be strengthened over the coming years.
Well, that's an interesting point there. Is this a moment to re-strengthen a political movement and political leadership? Because clearly our guests think we need real leadership that's more connected to the people. Our thanks to Colin Coffey for joining us this hour. And John Elson, wonderful to see you both, and thanks for your ideas and expertise this hour.
It was wonderful. Thanks to be.
All right, short break. More connections next.